Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, Marion Nestle, has dedicated her life to raising awareness about food politics. And she poses questions like, what is wrong with the U.S. food system? Why is half the world starving while the other half battles obesity? Who decides food issues? And why can't we do better with labeling, safety, and school meals? She's written several books tackling these complex questions, but she says they're hard to answer in an engaging way for a broad audience. So she's turned to 250 of her favorite cartoons and comics on issues ranging from genetic engineering to childhood obesity. She's always used these cartoons and comics in her public presentations to communicate how politics influences our food choices. And now she's using them in her newest book, Eat, Drink, Vote, an illustrated guide to food politics. Marion Nestle is professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health and professor of sociology at New York University. She's the author of a number of award-winning books, including Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health, and Safe Food, The Politics of Food Safety. And we are going to have Marion Nestle in just a couple minutes. I think we're having some phone problems, as you can hear. Sorry about that. So before we do that, I'll just talk a little bit about what she tackles in her book. She writes about everything from the food movement, buying local, buying organic, choosing to go vegetarian, which is one of my favorite sections. She talks about feeding children, who decides food issues, food safety, food labeling. And we will talk about what's currently happening in Washington. As you remember, in California, a proposition to label genetically modified food went down in November. Well, just in a couple of months, Washington State will be voting on a similar labeling law. And just like what happened in California, there's a lot of money going to the other side. So you've got DuPont and other biotech and food manufacturers who are trying to fight this law. They've spent over $11 million. And a number of organic food companies that you might not know, multinationals own these companies, are also opposing this law. So we'll be talking about food labeling also with Marion Nestle this hour. And I believe we now have Marion. Hi, Marion. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, glad to be here.
Oh, great. You're there. So nice to have you. So I was just talking about the food labeling laws and what's going down in Washington, and we'll talk about that. But first off, I just want to ask you, I love your book. I have to say, I read it last night at an ice cream parlor, and the cartoons actually caught the attention of some of the people I was sitting next to. And they said, oh, wow, what are you reading? And we started talking about food politics. Now, that definitely wouldn't have happened if I had one of your other books, I bet.
No, they probably would have yawned and said too many words on a page. I just thought this was the best project. It fell into my lap, and the idea of being given 1,100 cartoons to pick from and not have to buy permissions to use them was just too attractive an opportunity to pass up. So this was a wonderful project.
Yeah, and I love these cartoons. Now, you say that it's really hard to talk about food politics without putting a broad audience to sleep. What has your experience been like when you tackle these very important issues in front of a broad audience?
Well, people are surprised. Most people don't put the words food and politics together in the same sentence, let alone right next to each other.
And so I'm always having to explain why food is political.
And so what's the response? I mean, do people, is it just too much for them? Do they not get it? Because as you say, this affects all of us.
Oh, no, I think everybody gets it right away. They've just never thought about it before. Mm-hmm. But once people start thinking about it, the politics that go into determining what we eat and how our food system works are pretty obvious to people. And the minute they start thinking about it, they get it right away.
It's amazing to see how the processed food industry and the junk food industry, well, they kind of go hand in hand, but just how they've exploded over the past couple of decades. How has food politics really changed over the past, say,
well,
three
I
decades?
Think the, The big change in food politics is that people are so interested in food issues. That didn't used to be the case. Food has always been political. It's always been big business. And the root of the political parts of it are very simple. Food companies don't like it if government agencies tell people not to eat their products. And their job is to sell more food, not less. And so they want the government promoting that in every way possible. That gets very political right away. And it involves lobbying. It involves election campaign laws. It involves behind-the-scenes kinds of activities. It involves trying to influence friends and neutralize critics. And all of those kinds of things go on in every aspect of the food system. There is, for example, no food company is without a lobbyist.
Well, and we often...
Everybody has to have one.
Like Wall Street lobbyists, the gun lobby, the weapons lobby. But we don't hear, we know the food lobby exists, but we don't hear about it as often as the other lobbies.
Well, because the food is so complicated and there are so many different kinds of food. Guns, everybody knows what guns are. All guns are the same. They have the same purpose. They're exactly the same. Foods are really varied. There are thousands of food companies making hundreds of thousands of food products. And the messages about food are not, you don't eat. You have to eat in order to live. The messages are complicated. It's eat this instead of that. Or if you're worried about weight, eat less in general.
Can you name some of the major food lobbyists and can you talk about how much influence they have?
Well, I can't name them by name. I can just say that any large food company has lobbyists in Washington that are in there to defend their turf. For example, the soda industry, which is very much under attack right now, as more and more evidence comes out that sugary drinks are associated with obesity and particularly childhood obesity, the soda industry is very eager to make sure that the government makes no statements about drinking less sodas. They are also very concerned about sugar policy and corn growing policy because they want the sources of the sweeteners in sugar sweetened beverages to be as cheap as possible. They're very concerned about farm policy for that reason, and they're lobbying on all of those issues.
And what is the effect? Because we've seen some pieces of legislation at the state level to try to tax soda. What happens when those bills are introduced or those propositions are introduced?
Well, companies spend a great deal of money to defeat the propositions, and in many cases, they're successful. For example, in California, Richmond and El Monte had little tax initiatives last year, and soda companies spent about $4 million to defeat them and were quite successful in defeating them. But the initiatives keep popping up everywhere, and eventually, some of them are going to pass.
According to Open Secret, some of the top lobbyists are the Grocery Manufacturers Association, the Beverage Association. McDonald's is right up there, number four. Coca-Cola, Dunkin' Brands, Hershey, Kellogg. So just all the major brands.
Yeah, every food company either belongs to a trade association. The American Beverage Association is the main trade association for Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola, for example. Certainly the big food companies have their own lobbyists and they spend a lot of money to get those lobbyists to be busy in Congress, and they are.
And what's really interesting is while we were connecting with you, I was talking about efforts to label GMOs in Washington state after it failed in California. And what a lot of people learned during that pretty heated fight in California is that a lot of the multinationals own the organic companies. So, for example, Coca-Cola owns Odwalla. I think Pepsi owns Naked Juice. I mean, it's just a lot of people didn't realize that their favorite, what they thought were small brands, are actually owned by multinationals.
Yes, one of the things that the pro-GMO labeling forces are doing is putting out a lot of educational materials to educate the public about who supports what. And it's certainly the big cola companies, for example, are very, very much against GMO labeling and have put a great deal of money into fighting those initiatives. So it's not just Monsanto that's fighting the initiatives. It's also the grocery manufacturers and a lot of the food companies who buy genetically modified ingredients at very low cost. In the case of sodas, it's sugar beets. for the sugar or corn for the high fructose corn syrup.
Were you surprised when that law went down in California, or that proposition went down?
No, I had been following it very closely so I could see what was happening, and I've seen the graphs of public support for GMO labeling, and the minute the big influx of money, and I believe the figure was $37 million to defeat the California initiative, the minute that money started coming in, the support for the measure went down. The advertising was very, very cleverly done and framed in a way that made people think that if they passed this labeling law, food would cost more.
And right now in Washington, the companies and the labels fighting this include DuPont, Monsanto, Silk. A lot of people drink Silk soy milk, Naked, Honest Tea, Odwalla, Larabar. That's really popular. Also Santa Cruz Organic, Nutsen, Cashew Cereal, Garden Burger. They're all opposed to genetically modified labeling in Washington State.
Yeah, I don't know why any organic company would be opposed to it unless they were owned by a company that used genetically modified ingredients. Because if you don't want to be eating genetically modified food, it has to have an organic label on it or say no GMO. But the other companies, it's quite understandable. Silk, for example, is soy milk. It's made with soybeans. Roughly 90 to 95% of soybeans in the United States are genetically modified. So if you're drinking Silk, you're going to be drinking genetically, you know, something made from genetically modified ingredients, unless it's organic.
You have a section in your book about genetically modified food. What are cartoonists doing to get the point across? And what political stance are they taking on genetically modified foods?
Well, one of the things that was interesting about the cartoons in the book is I didn't always agree with the cartoonists on their particular point of view. But when it comes to genetically modified foods, the issues are so easy to satirize that pretty much across the board, cartoonists are making fun of them, are pointing out either their real or hypothetical dangers, and are in general being pretty hostile to the whole idea. There's something very satirizable about the idea that genes from one organism are being put into another. This doesn't have much to do with safety or with the benefits or risks of genetically modified foods, but it sure is fun.
There's a great cartoon. You've got a couple standing next to a hot dog cart, and they're saying they need to label genetically engineered salmon because the American public likes to know what it's eating.
Yes, and they're eating a hot dog, and
right.
Who knows what's in hot dogs.
Right.
Yes, pretty funny.
You know, the first cartoon that you put in your book is about the school lunch program, and it's a picture of a piece of pizza with, I think, a few pieces of pepperoni on it, and it says, New Congressional School Lunch Food Pyramid. Why did you choose that
yes.
one as the first cartoon?
Well, because it was very simple and didn't have a caption, first of all. It just says Congressional Food Pyramid, and the colors were right. And it also made the point very, very clearly about what was going to be in the book. Anybody who had been following what was going on with school lunches might recall that the Department of Agriculture's new rules for school lunch said that the tomato sauce that went on pizza could not be counted as a vegetable unless it reached a certain volume level. And here's where lobbyists came in, because lobbyists for the school pizza industry, there is such an industry, went right to Congress and got Congress to sneak in a codicil in an agricultural spending bill that forbade the Department of Agriculture for setting any volume limits on what could be counted as a vegetable on pizza for tomato sauce. And I thought this was astonishing. The idea that Congress would be micromanaging USDA school nutrition rules just seemed astonishing to me.
So what is the rule today? How does the U.S. government deal with pizza sauce today?
I think it has to be, it's a very, very small amount, less than a quarter of a cup. Will still count as a vegetable serving.
And so,
so the rule didn't change. They just left. When they put out the new rules for school food, they didn't change that one.
So what happened behind the scenes? I mean, were there politicians that wanted to change it, and then did they change their mind after the lobbyists showed up?
You know, it's very hard to know. If you look at the agricultural spending bill, which is very, very long and complicated, it has millions of sections in it, and you search for pizza. I mean, fortunately, you can do that. And up will come this little paragraph that says the Department of Agriculture will make no rule respecting the volume of tomato sauce that can count as a vegetable on pizza. So we know where the lobbying came from. It came from the companies that produce pizza for school lunch programs. And so they got some friendly congressperson to put that into the bill. And Congress was too busy with all of the other things in the law to pay much attention to it. I mean, if you start looking at these bills and looking how big and complicated they are, you know that no congressional representative can possibly know everything that's in there, and that it's really possible to put in little things and get them passed without ever discussing them. I'm not sure that one was ever discussed by Congress. It was just there.
How can we begin to make drastic changes when you still have tomato sauce counting as a vegetable?
Well, that's where the food movement comes in. And to me, that's the most exciting development in food politics in ages and ages. The large number of people, many of them young, who are really concerned about food issues, want to create a food system that's healthier for people and the environment, and are willing to, as I put it, vote with their forks and vote with their vote to get it. And I see that's where the grassroots effort, you know, right now we can't get anything done in Congress, you know, give up on Congress. It's really pretty hopeless right now. They can't even pass a farm bill. And so it's things at the grassroots level, either in cities or at the state level, which is why these state initiatives are so important, are where people can really get involved and have an impact.
We're speaking with Marion Nessel about her latest book, An Illustrated Guide to Food Politics, Eat, Drink, Vote. And she tackles these issues on a regular basis. She's dedicated her life to raising awareness about food politics and says sometimes these issues are hard to deal with in an engaging way for a broad audience. So she's turned 250 of her favorite cartoons and comics on a wide range of issues ranging from genetic engineering to childhood obesity. And we'll talk about more of these cartoons. Some of them are, they say so much more than any article really could. And we'd love to hear from you. What questions and comments do you have about food politics? What changes have you seen over the last couple of years with the food movement, especially in Northern California? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. What changes would you like to see? We're going to talk about everything from, well, we're talking about school lunches, but also just how to move toward a better and more affordable food system. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Ruby in Mill Valley. Hi, Ruby. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much. Marion Nessel is a goddess to me. and I am, thank you very much. I've been following her and reading her and loving how she always puts things. I'm always talking to people about this subject, and I'm particularly interested in nutrition labels, and I can get across by going into people's refrigerators and pulling out a product and saying, okay, this says 32 grams of sugar. Do you know how many teaspoons that is? So I give them a little thing where I raise four fingers, and I say it's like waving to grandma, and then I raise one thumb. So it's 4 grams and one teaspoon. Now, so many skeptics about so many things. I do not preach to the choir. I'm with a lot of different kinds of people, and I need a definition of what is food politics. What is that? And why are GMOs bad? Because I get those questions to me, and I'm at a cocktail party or, you know, a barbecue or something, and I need to come up with answers. Why are GMOs bad? What are food politics? And isn't a tomato a fruit?
I can handle the last one. Yes, tomatoes are fruit, but so what? It's commonly called a vegetable, and I'm happy to have it be a vegetable. They're terrific in the backyard, no matter what they are. A definition of food politics, it's the economic, cultural, social, and political factors that affect food, and from production to consumption. It's everything that has to do with the system in which food is produced and consumed. Your question about GMOs, you're already assuming that GMOs are bad. That's not the way I would put it. I would put it that there are many, many issues about GMOs. One of them is that the industry has really never produced foods that consumers want or particularly need. And it's all been for the production industry, and it hasn't been something that's been very consumer friendly. But I can tell you that what concerns me most about GMOs is a question of who controls our food system and who makes choices about what we eat, with the most obvious example being the non-disclosure, whether the public is right, wrong, or someplace in between about wanting GMOs labeled. The industry is very much opposed to it, and I think they should be labeled. It would solve a lot of problems.
Where do you get your information about the science of genetically modified foods?
Where do I get it?
Yes.
I wrote a book called Safe Food, The Politics of Food Safety, and half of the book is about genetically modified foods. I read the scientific literature. And I read quite a lot of it. And the science of GMOs is very complicated. In fact, I have my favorite footnote in that book is something from a scientific article explaining how a particular genetically modified product was constructed. And I've got diagrams about how it's done. I tried to make the book as reader-friendly as I possibly could for people who aren't trained in science. And, you know, our students at NYU read it all the time, and they do okay with it. So I think it's possible to explain the science in a way that people understand. But I read a lot of science.
Are you
my doctorate is in science, so I'm able to do that.
Are you concerned about the increasing number of scientists who actually work for the industry?
Oh, yes, and the increasing number of nutritionists who work for the industry. It's an enormous problem. It's very, very difficult to get unbiased opinions about these kinds of issues, with the most obvious example being sponsored research. I'm particularly interested in sodas these days because I'm working on a book about them. And I'm, you know, just stunned that you can predict the outcome of a scientific study if you look to see who sponsored it. Studies that are sponsored by soda companies invariably come out with results that say that sodas are really not a problem and they're not associated with obesity and there's no reason why anybody should be worried about them. Studies that are independently sponsored tend to come to different conclusions.
We've got about a minute left, Marion, but since you're working on a book about soda, what are you learning about soda that you didn't know before?
Oh, how extraordinarily comprehensive the industry's efforts are to sell sodas to people. There is no stone unturned. And I don't just mean advertising and marketing. It's getting down to the community level and doing just what cigarette companies used to do, sponsoring arts organizations, community organizations, playgrounds, schools, just anything that you can think of. The comprehensiveness of the efforts to market sodas and to protect the ability to sell sodas is absolutely breathtaking.
We're speaking with Marion Nessel, professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health, and professor of sociology at New York University. She's the author of a number of award-winning books. Her latest is Eat, Drink, Vote, an illustrated guide to food politics. And she decided that sometimes it's difficult to deal with these issues in an engaging way for a broad audience. So she's turned to 250 of her favorite cartoons and comics on a number of issues. And we'll talk about a great one that focuses on food stamps right after this.
And you are listening to Your Call on KALW San Francisco. Matt Martin here with Joe Burke. 2 minutes to ask for your support for Your Call and this kind of conversation that you're hearing today. We have Marion Nessel's book, Eat, Drink, Vote, an illustrated guide to food politics that breaks down so many important issues. Yours for a contribution of $120 to KALW.
800-525-9917 or online at KALW.org. Matt, from the pledge room, the phone room, I've just been handed a challenge for
right
us during
on,
this
out.
Hour. $1,000 are on the line, and the number of calls?
15 calls or clicks before the end of this hour.
Okay, and we have this wonderful thank you gift, the book, Eat, Drink, Vote. So if you were to perhaps choose that as your thank you gift, a book that'll teach you how to vote with your fork. You can vote with your telephone or your computer as well and support KALW.
800-525-9917 or KALW.org. The way it works is that if we get 14 calls or clicks, no money, no additional funds come to KALW.
But if we get 15?
15, that means $1,000 from generous listeners like you who've said, we want to support your call, we want to support KALW and all the programming that happens at this very special station.
800-525-9917 or online at KALW.org. Marion Nestle's book, Eat, Drink, Vote, is our special thank you gift for this hour, and we hope you will take this opportunity to support local public radio here during our fall membership campaign.
800-525-9917. Marion Nestle is she's a scientist. She's one of the leading nutrition voices, and she's someone who knows how to put the science in terms that those of us who aren't scientists can understand. She breaks down a range of issues: irradiation, GMOs, the obesity question, food marketing, pesticides, and says, "Hey, let's really look at the facts." Your support keeps this kind of conversation coming. Thank you. 800-525-9917.
KALW.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Tomorrow, we'll have a conversation with environmental activist Josh Fox about his latest documentary, Gasland 2, a sequel to the Oscar-nominated Gasland, which is about fracking. We'll talk about fracking here in California and the movement that we're seeing across the country against fracking. And then on Wednesday, we'll have a conversation with The Guardian's columnist Gary Young about his latest book, The Speech, the story behind Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream. Today, we are speaking with Marion Nestle, professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health, and professor of sociology at New York University. She's the author of a number of award-winning books. Her latest is Eat, Drink, Vote, an illustrated guide to food politics. And this one focuses on so many issues, and she includes 250 of her favorite cartoons and comics on a number of issues, ranging from GMOs to childhood obesity to food stamps and sodas. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What questions or comments do you have about food politics and how you make choices? There's a lot of controversy about how much the government should get involved in these issues. So what are your thoughts on that in terms of passing legislation to, say, for example, limit sodas in schools? This is just getting a lot of attention, and also labeling genetically modified food. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Marion, we were talking about soda before the break, and this is so connected to the role the government should play. And you've got a great cartoon in here. Unfortunately, I can't name the cartoonist because their names are often hard to read. But this one says, "I do not want the government telling me what to do. Leave that to the fast food industry." And there's this guy basically looking at these massive signs that say you need a 64-ounce soft drink, make it king size, add bacon. So talk a little bit about that, the role the government plays here. And how do cartoons deal with this question?
Well, the government is deeply involved in our food system, deeply, and the way that it is involved is to promote and support the food system exactly as it is now, with a great deal of support for industrially produced foods and much less support for fruits and vegetables, for organic farmers, and for the kinds of things that a lot of people in the food movement wish we could have more of. So a lot of the pressure is to try to change that, particularly because of obesity and the need to try to create a healthier food system that will make it easier for people to eat more healthfully without having to think about it. We know that education about what to eat isn't enough. You can tell people to eat fruits and vegetables until you're blue in the face, but if the fruits and vegetables aren't right in front of them, if they're not cut up, and if they don't taste good, people aren't going to eat them. So the idea is to change the environment to make it easier for people. And this particular cartoon was aimed at Mayor Bloomberg in New York, his suggestion that sodas should be capped at 16 ounces. an extremely controversial, it turned out to be an extremely controversial proposal. Right now it's in the courts. The courts have said it's not legal, and we'll see what happens with that. But the cartoonists in general, and as I mentioned earlier, I don't always agree with the cartoonist's point of view on this. Many cartoonists are libertarians and think that the government really ought to stay outside of what seems like personal food choices. I would argue that people don't make personal food choices in a vacuum. The government is already involved, and I would rather have the government be involved on the side of health than where it is now. But the cartoonists don't see it that way. And it's just much, much easier for them to criticize, to ridicule, and to think that something like the 16-ounce soda cap was a completely ridiculous and obtrusive idea, when in fact I thought it was well worth a try.
There's another great one. There's a Wall Street executive in jail, and the cops are saying, "We were finally able to put him away for drinking too large of a soft drink."
Yes, exactly. The idea being that the city is going to enforce this 16-ounce soda cap when there are all these bankers who are, stealing the country blind, and nothing ever happens to them. That's the way our system works. When I was trying to figure out what to do with the book, I loved a lot of these cartoons, even though I didn't always agree with them. And I was trying to figure out how to deal with that. And I finally decided just to let the cartoons speak for themselves. And in the text that I wrote to support the cartoons, I give my own opinion and say what I think. And I figure readers can read it and make up their own minds.
Well, we've got full lines, so let's hear from Jane in Corte Madera. Hi, Jane. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for taking my call. I've been trying to gain weight for a long time, and I can't seem to do it. And a nutritionist told me that I should eat several eggs, eat a lot of eggs. I want to know what the current skinny is on eggs. Are they good for you? Are the people who are tossing the yolks doing a silly thing? What's going on with egg whites, et cetera?
Okay. Let's talk about eggs. But let me first say that if you want to gain weight, you have to eat more calories than you're expending in physical activity. And I don't think it matters where those calories come from. So you just have to eat more. You're not eating enough if you want to gain weight. What an amazing position to be in. Most people would kill for what you're trying to do. Eggs used to be really controversial because they are very high in cholesterol. And for people who have high blood cholesterol, it's probably not a very good idea to eat a lot of them. But the general recommendations are if you have 3 or 4 or 5 a week, nothing terrible is going to happen to you.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Jane. Let's go to our next caller, Harry in San Francisco. Hi, Harry. Welcome to the show.
Yes. Good morning, Rose. I understand that China is now the largest exporter of fructose, which is the cheapest sugar available now. And a lot of people believe that going to Jamba Juice and loading up on a fruit juice drink is healthy. And could Marion Nessel talk about the health positives and negatives of fructose and fruit juice?
Yeah, I got caught on the Chinese are the biggest exporters of fructose. I hadn't heard that, and I'll look into it. Thanks for bringing it to my attention. Fructose is a naturally occurring part of high fructose corn syrup and of table sugar. We get most of our sugar, most of our fructose from table sugar, the white stuff that's on the table that comes from sugar beets and sugar cane, and a lot of it is grown in the United States. And the high fructose corn syrup, which has about the same amount of fructose as table sugar, that comes from corn. There's a big concern about fructose because in very large quantities, it seems to be metabolized in ways that the body doesn't handle very well. But good advice across the board is to eat less sugar. There's very, very little fructose that's being consumed just as fructose. There's a few foods that have it, and maybe you can buy it in the grocery store, but most sugar is a mixture of glucose and fructose, about half and half.
And the connections between fructose and obesity are pretty incredible.
No, it has to do with, I mean, it's sugar in general. Obesity is about calories, and where the calories come from, I think, is less important than the number of calories. But it seems pretty clear that large amounts of fructose are not a good idea.
Right. And there's actually 60 Minutes actually did a really good in-depth piece about sugar. And I think they had a doctor on from UCSF. So you might want to just search.
Yeah, Robert Lusser.
Right. Yeah. 60 Minutes and sugar. Thank you for calling, Harry. Let's go next to George in San Francisco. Hi, George.
Hi, good morning. We were hoping that Marion Nissel could comment on the seeming correlation of the current interest in obesity with the introduction of genetically manufactured organisms. What correlation could there be, do you think, between GMOs and the obesity epidemic?
The obesity epidemic started before GMOs. It started in the early 1980s, and the big rise was from 1980 to 1990, 1995. GMOs didn't start until, they weren't approved until 1994. So from a temporal standpoint, there isn't much of a correlation. And I doubt very much that there is any kind of biological relationship other than calories.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, George. I think we're going to do a show about GMOs in the near future to talk about the new information that's coming out and to parse the facts versus the fiction. Today, we're joined by Marion Nissel, professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health, and professor of sociology at NYU. And she's the author of a number of books, including her newest, Eat, Drink, Vote, An Illustrated Guide to Food Politics. And she's turned to 250 of her favorite cartoons and comics on all of these very important issues. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. What questions and comments do you have about food politics? And how does food politics change your choices? What sort of things have you learned over the last couple years that you maybe didn't know about beforehand? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So, Marion, there's another cartoon that I loved because we keep very close tabs on what's happening with food stamps just because the demand is so high and the Republicans want to cut $40 billion from the food stamp program. And you have this cartoon and it shows George W. Bush giving wads of cash to Homeland Security, military contractors, big oil, and corporate agriculture, basically saying, spare no expense, money makes the world go round. And then when it comes time to give wads of cash to the poor, the money hits the ground, and he says, giving handouts only encourages a culture of dependence. Sorry. I mean, I think that just says it all in
it
six
says
pictures.
It all. Yeah, it says it all, and you know, and it changes the way you think about it. You never think about government handouts as being corporate welfare. But in fact, that's what we have, especially in the agricultural area, with the direct payments that Congress can't seem to get rid of. And these are the payments that go to people who don't actually even farm. The poor are not much of a political force in the United States, even though there are 47 million of them who are getting food stamps or SNAP benefits now. And you would think if they got together and became a political force that somebody would have to pay attention to them. But in general, the poor are considered to not vote and to not be engaged in politics. They don't have money to contribute to election campaigns. They're not organized. And they are not in the same, and we as a country have an attitude towards the poor that we don't want to get them dependent on any kind of handouts. We have this idea that people need to take care of themselves, and certainly a lot of the cartoonists in the book take that position without much understanding of what it's like to take care of yourself if you don't have a job these days.
Well, and
there's a lot of unemployment.
Right. I mean,
big problem.
One of the cartoons shows this guy who maybe works for the census who knocks on a door of a couple and says, "Are you better off than you were 4 years ago?" And they say, "Yeah, we didn't qualify for food stamps then." And this Republican plan would cut $40 billion to nutrition programs over 10 years. And according to the Washington Post, this reduction would remove 76 million meals a year from New York City alone. I mean, that's really hard to comprehend, 76 million meals?
Yeah, I have a hard time believing that something like this can possibly get through even the current political system that we have, because the main beneficiaries of the SNAP program are the food companies and the retailers who sell food to people with SNAP benefits. I mean, that's so there's a huge food industry lobbying effort that's going into maintaining not only the SNAP benefits, but the ability of SNAP benefits to be used for their particular products. It's one of the big lobbying issues. So I have a hard time thinking that the food industry is going to allow this to happen. And I'd be very surprised if something like this gets as far as the president, who has said that he will veto it.
Can you elaborate?
We'll see.
Can you elaborate on that a bit? Because that part of it doesn't get much attention. So we've got spending on nutrition assistance programs would reach about $764 billion over 10 years if current policies continue. Where does that
right
money
now it's
go?
Right now it's about $80 billion a year. And most of that money goes to grocery stores. The way that it works is that the benefits are put on electronic cards, and they're called electronic benefit transfer cards. And they're just like a credit card, and people take those cards and go to a supermarket or go to a grocery store. Or if you're in New York City, they go to a drugstore, because drugstores have made sure that they have all of the specific foods that are required to qualify for taking EBT benefits. A grocery chain like Walmart is going to be the recipient of a great deal of EBT card expenditures. Really quite a lot. It's very difficult to get accurate information about this because the government does not collect money on where these benefits are spent or what kinds of foods SNAP recipients get. I think there should be a big research project to sort that out. We don't really have much information about that. But the information that is available suggests that Walmart sells 25% of the food in this country. It certainly gets 25% of the EBT transfer.
Wow.
Funds, and in some communities it gets a lot more than that. So it's very much to the benefit of retailers, to the grocery industry, and to the food products that are allowed to be purchased with EBT cards to make sure that the system continues. Because this is a transfer of wealth from taxpayers to not only to the recipients of these benefits who are going to eat the benefits, but also to the grocery stores that sell them.
You said that a number of the cartoonists follow the line that people are gaming the system and they're just lazy. Have you ever been in touch with any of these cartoonists?
Yes, I've met one of them. He's the one who did the cartoon of me at the end, which, by the way, I adore. But I've never had a cartoon of me before. I thought it was pretty exciting. And I heard him speak at a session at which another book that he'd been involved in came out. And he's somebody who kind of has the same kind of views of these things that I do.
And that cartoon shows Marion Nestle with a fork, and then the fork is holding a piece of paper that says vote. Vote with your fork, even better, vote with your vote. It's a nice cartoon of you, Marion.
Yeah, I think it's wonderful. And that's Clay Bennett. He's terrific. He works for a newspaper in Chattanooga, of all things.
We're speaking with Marion Nessel about her latest book, Eat, Drink, Vote, An Illustrated Guide to Food Politics. And we have just about 5 or so minutes left. So if you'd like to call in and talk about food politics, if you have any questions for Marion, we're also going to talk about what we can do about these issues. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What changes would you like to see? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We've got an email from Bill in Berkeley who says, have you ever written about how food advertising actually works to manipulate so-called personal food choices? And you've got a whole section in this book about that. I was shocked to learn, I shouldn't be shocked, I guess, but McDonald's advertising spending was $963 million in 2011.
Oh, and that's only in the United States.
Wow.
That doesn't count. That doesn't count globally, I don't think. Yeah, the figures on individual. I've written about it extensively in my book, Food Politics, and also in my book, What to Eat. I talk about food marketing a lot because most people aren't aware of the figures. It's very, very difficult to get figures on individual food products, but Advertising Age once a year publishes a few of them, and the one that sticks in my mind again because I'm particularly interested in soda. Is Coca-Cola spent $267 million in 2011 just to advertise Classic Coke, not any of the other products, just Classic Coke. And any breakfast cereal aimed at kids has an advertising budget of a mere $10 million a year or up to 50. Pop-Tarts are about $50 million a year. You can go through and pull out these figures. It's just staggering. The numbers are so high that they're incomprehensible. And you become kind of inured to them after a while. But an enormous effort. I mean, I think it's $36 billion a year on advertising and marketing dollars just for food and beverages and restaurants altogether. I mean, that's a big number, and public health people can't compete in that arena. Nobody can compete in that arena.
Are there any restrictions on advertising to children?
No, not really. Yes, there are some, but they're very minimal, and a lot of them have been, there's been an enormous pressure on food companies to restrict marketing to children, or at least to restrict it to children who are over the age of 12. Most of the efforts are voluntary. There are no mandatory restrictions. And the voluntary efforts don't work very well because companies can get around them so easily. They've pulled back on television advertising to children under 12, but it's hard to say what kids watch on television. And if they're watching any adult television at all, they're going to be seeing advertising. And a lot of the advertising has moved online where parents don't have a very good handle on it. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for the email, Bill. Let's go next to Cynthia in San Francisco. Hi, Cynthia. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Hi. First of all, I just wanted to say that I agree with completely a lot of what your guest is saying, and I appreciate her efforts. But she made a statement that table sugar is fructose, but I think it's sucrose. I just wanted to point that out, being an accuracy nerd. And I'll just leave it there. Thank you so much.
Sucrose is half glucose and half fructose. It's a double sugar. It's called a disaccharide, and it's made of 50% glucose and 50% fructose, and it represents about half of the fructose in American diets. The other half comes from high fructose corn syrup, which is roughly 50% glucose and fructose. It's got a little bit more fructose than that, but not much.
All right. Thank you. I wanted to ask you, since we have just a couple minutes left, about solutions. What are like the top three things you would change about the food system?
Well, I certainly would put restrictions on marketing to children. I think that's by far the most important thing to do. There is now an increasing body of research evidence that shows that kids who are not subjected to food marketing eat much more healthfully and are not eating as much junk food, since most marketing is for junk food, and aren't as fat as kids who are subjected to marketing. So that's the absolute number one thing to do. And of course, right now it's politically impossible. Another situation where politics comes into this, it's politically impossible to do anything about it right now. But that may eventually change. So that would be number one. Then I'm mostly interested in kids because I think that's where the real changes will take place over time. I want to teach kids how to cook.
Mm.
And I want kids to know where their food comes from and what food is all about. I think those would make enormous changes in kids' attitudes towards food. And they also ought to have some media literacy training so they learn how to recognize a commercial for what it is and understand the difference between something that's entertainment and something that is trying to sell them something.
Yeah, that's needed right now for sure. And then what about taking on the big lobbies, like the dairy lobby, the meat lobby, the soda lobby? What about that?
Well, for this, we have to change the main source of corruption in American politics, which is the way we fund election campaigns. And again, that's very difficult politically right now. The Supreme Court in 2010 passed Citizens United or had a ruling in Citizens United that made it possible for corporations to put vast amounts of money into election campaigns without declaring it. And this has made the system much worse. I think we need an electoral system in which candidates are restricted to a certain amount of money and that's it, and everybody gets exactly the same amount. Ooh, would that change our system quickly?
Yes, on every issue. And 30 seconds, Marion, what's really exciting you in the food movement right now?
Oh, the fact that everybody's in it. There's so many people in it. The enormous number of grassroots organizations that are working on these issues. When we at NYU started our food studies programs in 1996, we were pretty much it. Mm-hmm. Now every university has programs in food studies of one kind or another. I think all of this is going to really is heading in the right direction. It's absolutely thrilling to be working in this area right now, and bring them on.
Marion Nestle is professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health, and professor of sociology at New York University. She's the author of a number of award-winning books. Her latest is Eat, Drink, Vote, an illustrated guide to food politics. Thank you again, Marion, for joining us, and thanks so much for raising awareness about these issues. Thank you. And I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for listening. It's your call.